afternoon in the matter of State versus Cynthia Rivera. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Morgan A. Burke, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Ms. Cynthia Rivera.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, Assistant Prosecutor Patrick Galdieri, appearing for the state.
Good afternoon, Deputy Attorney General William P. Cooper Dobb, for the Attorney General's amicus curiae.
Welcome, counsel. Ms. Burke, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
The success of the sentencing process is the requirement that the trial judge articulate the reasons for imposing sentence. These reasons must be supported by credible evidence in the record. This process is critical in facilitating both appellate review and trust in the integrity of our system of justice. The trial court here made two major errors in articulating its reasons for imposing the sentence in this case. First, it used Ms. Rivera's age against her. And second, it failed to provide a reasoned explanation grounded in credible evidence for why Ms. Rivera, as a first-time offender, was likely to reoffend. First, the trial court used Ms. Rivera's age and aggravation, improperly finding that the only reason that she had no prior record was because she was young. The trial court gave great weight to aggravating factor 3, the risk of reoffense, and little weight to mitigating factor 7, her lack of criminal history, solely because it found that Ms. Rivera had not had enough time to begin a history of criminal activity. This use of youth and aggravation to overvalue aggravator 3 and undervalue mitigator 7 was error. In addition, the trial court's mere speculation that Ms. Rivera would commit more offenses if she had enough time is not a reasoned explanation to support the court's conclusion that this first-time offender was likely to reoffend. And the court's other reasons for finding risk of reoffense were similarly deficient. First, because it was viewing Ms. Rivera not as she was as she stood before the trial court on the day of sentencing. And second, because Ms. Rivera never planned the shooting in this case. And so the planning could not support the finding of aggravating factor 3 for the homicide charge or for the manslaughter charge. Thus, because the trial court failed to give the requisite reasoned explanation for why it found both aggravating factor 3 and mitigating factor 7 and failed to ground its decision in credible evidence in the record, Ms. Rivera must be resentenced. This concludes my opening statement. To begin, the trial court used Ms. Rivera's age and aggravation when it found that if nothing else, she hasn't had enough time to begin a history of criminal activity, finding that the only reason that she had not committed more crimes was because she was young, and therefore if she had more time, she would commit more offenses. But this use of youth and aggravation should not be permitted by this court. Our court has, in the past, the language of this court's past decisions have indicated that youth should generally inure to the benefit of a defendant, even when they're over the age of 18. But when we look at the juvenile cases in Miller and Zuber, we see that the brain science that animates these decisions still applies to a person like Ms. Rivera, who is just 7 weeks past her 18th birthday. She's very much still a teenager. Her brain is still developing. She still doesn't have the full capacity to control her impulses, regulate her risk-taking behavior, and really foresee the consequences of her actions. And so when the court finds that the only reason she hasn't committed more crimes is because she hasn't had enough time to do so, uses her age in aggravation, and that should be held impermissible by this court. We know from decades of case law here and legislation now that—
So I understand your position and your argument, which is well-placed based upon the words used by the sentencing court. But is it your argument that the court, in explaining why it might not give much, if any, weight to mitigating factor 7 and might give greater weight to aggravating factor 3, the court can't mention youth or where someone is in their life at all?
Absolutely not. In fact, Ms. Rivera believes that youth should be used in her sentencing decision. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but if it is used, it has to be used in mitigation, and to discount or reduce the weight given to a mitigating factor and increase the weight given to an aggravating factor based on her youth.
But don't we expect courts to explain their reconciliation of the tension between mitigating 7 and aggravating 3? Our case law has talked about that. So if we expect courts to talk about it, how does the court do it without dealing with this objective fact of, you know, her age at the time of offense?
Well, here, this explanation would be, when using the youth as an explanation for this, it would always work to the detriment of the defendant if we use it this way, because it would always mean that a person who has never had a criminal history who is young doesn't matter because they're young and they would have more time to commit more offenses. And if they do have a criminal history, it would potentially discount this factor altogether. So mitigating factor 7 would almost never have any weight to it, or very little weight, while aggravating factor 3 could always be applied. Because if aggravating factor 3 applies to someone who does not have a criminal history just because they haven't had enough time to do so yet, it means that any person who is a young person in front of the court, it's the court just says, hey, they just haven't had time, so I think in the future they will.
And so, that your argument rests on the fact that the way the court explained itself was impermissible.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Counsel, I want you to clarify something about what you believe the judge did, and in particular, what the judge considered with respect to aggravating factor 3, because it seems like the trial court judge, I'm looking at the transcript beginning at page 11, did what trial judges do. They went factor by factor,
gave the reasons for each factor, beginning with aggravating 3, then aggravating 9, then moving on to mitigating 7, where the judge speaks about youth and the beginning of adulthood and so on, then mitigating 12. Where is it in the
record of the judge's comments, as you see it, for
where the judge
relies on youth for aggravating 3?
So I look at page 13, and starting mostly at page 13, line 13, which is that, though I am most certainly not sentencing her for anything in the future that I think she could have committed, I'm just finding that, you know, if nothing else, she hasn't had enough time to begin a history of criminal activity, which I most certainly think would have been the case. And that being the reason why I give great weight to the fact that the risk she'll commit another offense, aggravating factor 3. So that goes to it's more to the weighing of these factors. And what the court here, it was seeming to attempt to make this reasoned explanation that case requires for why both of these factors apply here. But the fact of he's saying she's young, I don't think she hasn't committed crimes because of that. And that's why I'm giving little weight to aggravating or mitigating factor 7. But also that's the reason why I can give great weight to mitigating or aggravating factor 3, because she just hasn't had enough time. And I think if she had the time, she would do so.
So your other argument about aggravating 3 is that she's not responsible or shouldn't be held responsible for the planning of a murder because that wasn't part of the case here. She pled to aggravating manslaughter, right?
Yes.
Did she know that Martinez had a gun?
She did, Your Honor.
Did she believe that he was going to use it during the course of a robbery?
According to the plea, yes, Your Honor.
Right. And so those are undisputed facts that, of course, the judge can rely upon. Is it reasonable for a judge to conclude the defendant would use a weapon, could
use a weapon
in the course of committing an offense based on those two admissions in particular?
Yes. And that's it is possible. But what Ms. Rivera was convicted of was aggravated manslaughter as an accomplice, so that she was not the one with the gun. She was not the person who actually shot the victim in this case, and either victim in this case. And in fact, at the sentencing hearing, she said she never meant for anyone to die. This goes to her age as well. As a young person, the inability to really foresee the consequences, the lack of being, or the likelihood of engaging in risk-taking behavior, that they're not really foreseeing what might happen. This all kind of goes together. And and shows how she really didn't plan what happened here. And although it might be a consequence that happened based on her agreement to engage in the robbery, she never actually planned for this homicide to happen.
Based on her statement, she knew what a gun was and she knew what was it could be used for in that particular case. So how can you say that she didn't understand what a gun was, what it could be used for? She pled to that. How can you can you make that argument? She was young, a youth. She didn't know what a gun was for, and she didn't know how it would be used. She admitted that she knew what it was and what it was going to be used for. So how could the judge ignore that?
In this case, she admitted that she knew that Mr. Martinez would be bringing the gun to the robbery and that he was going to be using it in the robbery. And that is the elements for armed robbery. But it doesn't necessarily mean that she wanted him to shoot anybody, that she expected that to happen.
Why does that matter for purposes of what the judge did at sentencing? Isn't the judge permitted to rely upon her statement? She believed that Martinez was going to use the gun in the robbery and factor that into aggravating three and the planning and knowledge that went into the offense to which she pled guilty.
In this case, there's just no evidence, though, that she actually planned for the manslaughter to happen. And so to apply an aggravating factor to that offense for something that she never intended, that she never meant to happen.
I'm concerned that we're getting stuck on labels. Sure. Let's focus on the facts. The judge said, I'm relying on aggravating three in part because of her planning. And her planning included her knowledge and belief that he was going to use a gun during the commission of an offense. I'm struggling as to why that was an inappropriate consideration for the judge with respect to factor three.
Please go ahead, explain.
So in State v. Sherman, which is an appellate division case, this court or the appellate division found that although the defendant there planned a kidnapping, he didn't plan to endanger the child that he kidnapped. And so even though he ended up endangering that child, the planning of the kidnapping could not support the aggravating factor with the reasoning that he planned it for the endangering charge.
It sounds like you're making a distinction between her knowing that a gun would be used in the robbery, but not knowing that it was going to be used in order to kill the victim. So it sounds like your argument is she knew that there would be a gun might be used to threaten the victims in order to cause them to turn over the property in the robbery, but not necessarily used in the sense of shooting the victims. Is that what you're
saying? Exactly, Your Honor. And so that makes a difference when we're undergirding the reasoning for a specific aggravating factor for a specific offense.
And you're also arguing, as I understand it, the judge has to sentence the person before him. And at the time he is sentencing Ms. Rivera, she has already cooperated with the state. She's cooperating with the state. She's expressed remorse. Yes, she said that she was part of the robbery. She pled guilty to that in the aggravated manslaughter. But aggravating factor number three, is the question of whether or not there is a risk that she will commit another offense. And that is the factor he is considering with all of the evidence. Of course, she pled guilty. But the question is, was that factor well-founded? You're arguing, also taking into consideration her youth. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And to your point, Justice Albin, Ms. Rivera came in front of the court and the court said, I think that if she hadn't been captured in this case, her mindset and her way of thinking, she would have continued to commit more offenses with Mr. Martinez. But that completely discounts who Ms. Rivera was at the time of her sentencing, which was that she had been arrested in this case. She did give a statement to the police and cooperate. She did express remorse. She had broken up with Mr. Martinez, who had been abusing her throughout their relationship. She found out that she was pregnant, had given birth while she was in jail. There were so many things that happened between the offense and the sentencing that the trial court just did not look at all and only looked at her at the time before she was arrested. And that cannot support this reasoned explanation for why she would be likely.
That's not exactly what the judge said. The judge said, I believe she had not been caught based on her behavior, that she wouldn't have cooperated. She had been caught. So the judge was using his fact-finding ability, his instinct to apply the factor. So he didn't say, he said, if she hadn't, I believe she had, if she had not been caught, she wouldn't have cooperated, would have committed another one. Based on her behavior, the fact that she got caught and then started cooperating doesn't negate that, in my mind, at least.
So, Your Honor, I would look to page 13, and this is lines 8 through 12, which is that I find if she had not been captured in this particular instance, her mind frame and the way her thinking and her relationship with Mr. Martinez could very well have resulted in additional crimes being committed.
Okay.
And so this is the judge saying that if none of the things that had happened, she would have committed more crimes. But that...
He can't analyze that and think that?
No, because at this point, she's a different person. And
at this point, she got caught and she pled guilty. She may or may not be a different person. And that's what the judge was saying.
But the facts on the record and what the record indicates is that things had changed because she had been captured and she had been arrested.
So you get a credit for being caught and being arrested.
It's not necessarily a credit, Your Honor. It's just
what is it if it's not a credit?
It's a change in circumstances that is important to look at when
he did.
Sentencing the defendant.
He looked at it and said, if she hadn't been caught, I believe she would have committed all the crimes. And so why can't the judge do that?
Under Jaffe, we have to look at the defendant only as she stands on the day of the court at sentencing.
She stands on that day caught?
Correct.
Pleading?
Correct.
But that doesn't change her state of mind, which is what three is about.
Absolutely. But the judge is looking at her as if that hadn't happened, and her state of mind is, at least on my reading, contingent on the fact that she had not been caught and that she was still with
her. Your position is that when you look at likelihood of reoffense, you don't look at the moment before she was caught. This judge is sentencing the person on the day of sentence. And the question is, on the day of sentence, is she likely to reoffend if I don't put her in jail or if I don't impose a heavy sentence? That is the issue before
the final
sentence. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Factor three cannot be used for anyone who's been arrested or in jail, because obviously, and they're in jail, they're not going to commit a crime because they're not free. So you can never apply factor three in the way the judge did if someone's been arrested and going to jail, because obviously when they're in jail, they're not going to come out and rob someone or use a gun because they're in jail. So factor three is off the boards if someone is going to go to jail.
Not necessarily. Not necessarily, but in this case, she is at this point incapacitated because she is incarcerated. Mm-hmm. But that's the inquiry is based on who she is at the time and if she is going to reoffend once she is released.
Correct that we look at the day of sentencing, of course, and the individual who is appearing in front of the judge at that moment. Does the seriousness of the offense weigh in that calculus? So, for example, if you had somebody who had committed a dastardly murder, a heinous murder, who then pled guilty and cooperated against others.
You're not suggesting, I take it, that a judge could not find aggravating factor three, correct?
Absolutely not. And that could be part of the court's decision making here. But it has to be based on the facts in the record that show that this was specifically planned for, specifically carried out in the way that it was that the person wanted it to be carried out.
So again, is it reasonable for a judge to infer, based on the admissions that she made about the planning stage of this case, that someone could have been seriously injured
during the course of the robbery that she was planning?
That is potentially an inference. However, but when we're looking at the judge's decision here, his decision was she planned this. She lured these victims to the level of victimization that happened. And that's the issue here, is that she never intended for that to happen. She didn't plan to lure to the level of victimization.
What she did? And isn't that exactly what the judge said on pages 11 and 12? In fact, she was the one, he said, to get them from point A to point B. She actually manipulated the circumstance. In other words, we're taking a line, two lines out of context. This was a fairly, it was a sentencing that had a lot in it. Didn't he say exactly that? She lured them from point A to point B. She was involved in the planning with Martinez. She admitted she knew he had a gun. And he relied on the fact that she was apparently very much in her mind or way of thinking at the time. And her involvement with Martinez at the time, this was a pretty horrible offense. And he took that and gave it great weight. Isn't that right?
The problem with what the trial court did here, though, is that he took the planning and expanded it beyond what Ms. Rivera actually pleaded to. She said she agreed with Mr. Martinez to rob the victim in this case. And that was pretty much all that she admitted to in the plea. And the plea or in the plan, according to the PSR, was to meet someone in the Bronx and to never make it to the motel, never actually get to a riskier situation. And this all, again, comes back to her age and her just not really foreseeing what is going to happen here. And the fact that the trial court looked at this plan and then himself admitted that the plan went awry and that things happened and that she never expected to happen. And so to use the planning to undergird the reasoning.
If she didn't plan it, how did she know that it went awry? Because if she had no part in planning it, she couldn't have known what was going to happen, according to what you're saying. So how could she say it went awry when she had no idea what the actual plan was?
Well, the initial plan was for them to meet in the Bronx, and then things went.
That was it. I'm gonna meet in the Bronx, go get a cup of coffee, some iced tea.
It was to meet in the Bronx, and then there, that was when the robbery was supposed to happen.
So she knew it was gonna be a robbery.
Yes.
And if she didn't know what was going to happen, how could she say she didn't know it went awry? If she had no idea what the details were, how can you not knowing any details? How can you say that something went awry? You have no idea whether it did or it didn't.
So the whole thing was supposed to be over in the Bronx. It was supposed to end there. So when things went haywire and there was another attempted robbery.
Does that tell you she was part of the planning? If she knew where it was supposed to end and how it was supposed to end?
Absolutely. And that it goes straight to the risk perhaps for planning the robbery. But anything that happened after that, she didn't plan. And so to undergird the reasoning for an aggravating factor for an offense that she did not plan, it goes against the fairness of sentencing someone for what they actually had planned to do.
I don't mean to minimize what occurred, because what occurred was terrible. But one of the other factors, I guess, that no one was planning for was that one of the victims was armed with a gun. So
absolutely.
When they were going to Woodbridge and she was there, she knew that one of the people who she was consorting with, yes, she was setting him up for robbery, had a gun himself.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the state actually points out in its brief is that she texted Mr. Martinez saying, hey, this person has a gun and we are now in New Jersey. But it leaves out the middle part of that text message, which said, I'm scared. The text message was, he pulled a gun on me. I'm scared, New Jersey. And so there's, doesn't it doesn't really.
Doesn't that undermine your entire argument? They go to the bodega. They're going to commit the robbery it's supposed to be committed. He's now got a gun. She knows Martinez has a gun. And she's the one that directs them and instructs Martinez, I'm going to guide them over the hotel where you're both armed and we're going to commit that robbery. She doesn't say it quite like that. But that's essentially what happened. Doesn't that undermine your whole argument about her involvement and her planning and support what the chief was asking you?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because this indicates to me that she didn't plan any of this. So then going forward, she's now caught up in these circumstances. She's in a car with a man with a gun who has taken away her phone. She has to sneak away to get her phone to text someone. And she's now—
Text Martinez.
Yes. But at that point, he would know where she was and could help and perhaps come help her. And so what the evidence seems to indicate is that she never actually intended for the murder still to happen, but if anything, that somebody come help her and that she is now stuck in this position that she doesn't know where she is. She cannot get there or she can't leave because she was driven.
And the victim was accusing her in the Bronx of setting yes. up. So she was in a dangerous situation with someone who's in the Bronx accusing. I'm not lessening her culpability for the aggravated manslaughter. Just setting the circumstances up that she had reason to be fearful.
There definitely is. Ms. Rivera concedes she did in fact text with Mr. Martinez and agree to engage in this robbery in the Bronx. But the things that happened afterwards were just not in the scope of what she believed was going to happen. It was not something that she's planned. And for the trial court then to come in and say she planned this and she changed everything to lure the person to from A to B is not based in the evidence in the record. Is based in mere speculation about her beliefs at that time and what was going on at the time, and just cannot support this reasoned explanation for the manslaughter charge for the risk of reoffense based on the planning here. And that's
I'm not sure the judge said anything. The judge said, I attach great weight, as I indicated with Mr. Martinez, reading the discovery and reading what's been presented, and per the statements provided by each, meaning Martinez and this defendant, the way this case lines up is that this never would have happened if Ms. Rivera and Mr. Martinez hadn't put it together. They hadn't hatched this scheme, and to only take someone to lure them into the level of victimization. And then he goes into her going to the bodega and all this happening and her luring him back to the hotel. In context, even in context, the comment about she hasn't had enough time, he talks about her mind frame and her way of thinking and her relationship with Mr. Martinez could have resulted in additional crimes be committed, though I'm certainly not sentencing her for anything in the future that I think she could have committed. This was a toxic relationship, as you argued, toxic relationship, toxic circumstance, and all of the mitigation that you're talking about ended up getting her an ag man and an ag assault concurrent of 15 years instead of the sentence she was facing. I mean, isn't all of that part of the same? You can't take all this out of context. In context, it doesn't sound like what you're describing.
The trial judge can always go below what the plea has been offered and what the state is recommending for
that. That's what I'm saying.
And sure, but when we do look at what's happening here, Ms. Rivera did plan this robbery, and that is something that we can see. But to take that and say that she intended to go to the motel, she intended for this homicide to happen, was not part of the record below. All he said
was she directed them, which it's in her phone, it's texted, it's part of the record. She directed them from the bodega where everything went haywire, and she was the one who told Martinez where they're going to be, where she's taking them. To the motel so he could rob him.
And that again, though, Your Honor, again, even if this was to continue the robbery, it does not.
She admits it was.
Then it doesn't, but it still does not provide the support for the homicide charge and the manslaughter charge here because she still did not.
Are you arguing against the plea? Because when I look at the sentencing argument made by your predecessor counsel, their emphasis was fine for us, judge, these mitigating factors because we want to step down. What are you asking us now to do? Say that there wasn't enough evidence to support the plea?
Absolutely not. There's, and again, Ms. Rivera agreed to engage in this robbery. And so that supports the conspiracy to commit robbery. And then the homicide happened in the course of that happening. So there is definitely enough evidence to support the aggravated manslaughter here. However—
So my follow-up question then is it your position that there's not enough credible evidence for a sentencing judge to find aggravating factor 3 just based upon her involvement in planning this offense?
Not as to the manslaughter charge, yes. She did agree to plan the robbery, but she never planned for the homicide to happen. And so to hold that as a reason to apply this aggravating factor to her, to the manslaughter charge, is not based in credible evidence in the record.
And your youth argument, I take it. You're saying that he couldn't use the fact that she was 18 years old. And I have this premonition at the time that she's before me for sentencing, she would have committed like more crimes. Can't be perversely using her youth as an aggravating factor in order to bootstrap number three. That's your basic argument.
Yes, and that is something that the trial court really did was look at her and say, hey, if she only had more time, she was gonna commit more offenses. The only reason that she hasn't committed more offenses because she hasn't had the time yet. And that is impermissible.
And counsel, wouldn't you agree, as she stood before the court, she had no juvenile record. But if she did have a juvenile record, the argument partly would have been, well, she's been in contact with the criminal justice system since the age of X, and here's this juvenile history that, you know, that supports a finding that there might be more reoffense in the future. So it's and the state would make that, I'm assuming, would make that same argument. So it's using youth in one sense in certain circumstances as, well, not enough time to commit crimes, but when someone does have a juvenile history, they have had time to commit crimes and look at this juvenile history. So it's using youth, it would allow courts to use youth in both ways to say that, well, if someone doesn't have, someone's 18, they don't have enough time. But if they're 18 and they had a juvenile history, then they did have enough time. And either way, aggravating factor three should be applied.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that really goes
to the way you argue factor three can never be applied to anyone who's young. Anyone 18 or so, because you just can't apply, no matter what the facts are, no matter the fact that she set this up, that he knew he had a gun, she knew he might use it, and she was the one, the catalyst that got him to where they were. But that can't be considered because you're young. Is that the argument?
That is not the argument, Your Honor. There are plenty of circumstances where a person might be young and still get the finding of aggravating factor three.
I can't think of any based on your argument. Could you enlighten me and tell me one where it might be used? Because I can't think of any based on what I'm hearing from you.
Based on this, if someone comes in at 18 and has a lengthy juvenile record that has been held by this court to be adequate to support.
Is that the only criteria, lengthy juvenile record?
Not necessarily. Everything is specific to the case. So if there is an especially brutal murder that happens, as the chief pointed out earlier, there was this heinous crime that was planned to the T and it was followed out to the T, that could be support for this factor. However, in this case, that's not the facts before this court.
There was a robbery. She planned them. She was involved in getting them there. She was the catalyst that got them there.
It was a robbery that went wrong. And Ms. Rivera,
a lot of robberies go wrong. If you have a gun, they might go wrong. You never know if the other person has a gun or not. That's one of the risks of being involved, but still.
It is a risk,
but negated them because it went wrong. We meant to just, you know, take the money nicely, and we had to kill them. Is that the only way you can use Ag 3?
The problem here on these facts is just that she did not plan for this to happen, and when the court uses planning as its basis, and the plan was not actually in the record as such. That is the problem here, is the court has to ground its reasoning in credible evidence in the record, and the planning for this specific offense was not in the record.
Is it a reasonable inference for the court to draw that they were going to rob the person, their boyfriend had a gun, and he might use it? Is that sufficient for the judge to draw an inference from?
Not when the basis is planning. If there was another sort of basis that the trial court is using, perhaps, but in this case, what the trial court did was base it on planning. That is the issue.
It was an incomplete robbery.
Yes, it was.
Eventually it turned into a murder, but so unless you're planning to murder someone, court can't use it.
Cannot use
it. Specific intent to kill somebody or do something like that. It can't be, you plan a robbery, you have a gun, it's likely to happen. If something, they refuse to give the money or whatever, but that you can't consider that. I'm just trying to figure out what the parameters are for your Ag 3 analysis.
Not as to the manslaughter charge in this case. So that is the line here. And that's what Sherman said in the appellate division, was that if you plan one offense and something else happens in conjunction with that offense, that's the line that is drawn between applying that factor.
You're conceding that the depravity of the crime may come into play for aggravating three. So for example, had she grabbed the gun and shot the victim, that would be a completely different circumstance from the facts that we have here.
But she'd be pleading to murder then, not what she pled to.
Yes.
You also, I take it you'd have to concede based on what she pled guilty to, that she admitted participating in an event and the circumstances manifested extreme indifference to human life.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yet you keep focusing on she was only planning a robbery. Isn't this more than simply only planning a robbery?
In this case, the plea itself does indicate that there is a risk that something happened, or that something more might happen, and that there, that in that risk, there might be an extreme indifference to human life. But that still doesn't mean that when she went into it, and what the trial court is basing it off of is this plan that he seems to think that was made to lure these people, the victims, out to the motel and murder them there. That's just not based in the record here. And when we look at what actually happened, it does appear that things
just- Is that what she pled to, that they planned it? He seems to think that's what it was? Isn't that basically the facts? He didn't have to seem to think it, that's what it was.
The facts though don't indicate that they ever planned to actually murder, or at least Ms. Rivera did not actually plan to murder and had no knowledge that that was going to be
She pled guilty to reckless conduct.
Yes.
Recklessly causing death under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to human life. But the underlying state of mind was a heightened sense of recklessness.
Yes, Your Honor. And so that's why when we talk about planning, which talks about specific intent to do something, it just doesn't, it doesn't comport with undergirding a reasoning that this planning for the manslaughter charge itself can be used in aggravation.
Other questions, anyone? Is there anything else you'd like to add, Ms. Burke?
Just that for all these reasons, trial courts should not be able to use age and aggravation, and that if it's going to apply both aggravating factor three and mitigating factor seven, that there has to be some record and some evidence in the record to support that their reasoning for that. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Galdieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. Defendant's aggregate 15-year prison sentence in this case was the very sentence that she bargained for in her plea agreement with the state. And that sentence was imposed by Judge Jimenez only after he performed the qualitative assessment of the statutory sentencing factors that was required of him. For that reason, her sentence should be affirmed on appeal. I just want to talk about the aggravating factors first, and then the mitigating based on how the questioning kind of just transpired. As to aggravating factor three, the judge properly exercised his discretion in applying and giving it great weight. The judge focused on the defendant's extensive role in the commission of this crime, and that basically it really wouldn't have happened without her playing the part that she did. The plea agreement says in her factual basis that she knew Martinez, the co-defendant, had a gun. She knew he was going to be using the gun in committing the armed robbery to take the things from the target, and that she even told Martinez that the target also had a gun. The judge was essentially saying that based on all of that, she should have known that the shooting was foreseeable and perhaps even likely given her role in planning what happened. And then that's all from her factual basis. Based on the PSR and the statement that she gave after she was ultimately arrested, which by the way, occurred 3 weeks after all of this happened, after Martinez and Mingo were arrested. So she was the last of the three that actually even got arrested, and it wasn't until almost a month after the crime was committed. But in her statement that she gave to the police that was detailed in the PSR, they first went to the bodega, and she says that she thought that that's where the robbery that she planned with Martinez was going to happen when the two gunmen approached the car. And then after that, they then went to the motel in Broadridge from the Bronx in New York. And she at that point could have backed out. She could have just acquiesced and not said anything to Martinez, but she made a concerted effort to make the robbery happen by taking her phone back after it was taken by the target and texting Martinez their location, telling him that the target also had a gun. So she at that point knew that both people involved in this had guns, and told Martinez that, and knew that he knew that as well. So in that regard, the judge in finding aggravating factor 3 was properly focused on the circumstances of the offense and the nature of the offense, which is what this court has made clear time and again, is really one of, if not the primary focuses of a sentencing court. And as stated in the cases that are cited in the state's brief, the judge was permitted to find aggravating factor 3 based on the circumstances of the offense, and in a case where a defendant such as this defendant had no prior record. And then as far as mitigating factor 7, the judge didn't abuse his discretion when he explained why he was giving little weight to it in discussing her age. I think it's key that the judge didn't decline to find mitigating factor 7 based on the defendant being 18 at the time of the offense and then 19 at sentencing. The judge was explaining why he, in fulfilling his role to ascribe weight to that mitigating factor, decided to give it little weight. And he was also at the same time reconciling his findings of aggravating factor 3 and mitigating factor 7, which was certainly proper. And that's why when he discusses her age, based on what it says in the transcript, he wasn't using it against her. He was explaining why he was applying mitigating factor and giving her the benefit of that, why he was giving it little weight as opposed to moderate or great weight, I suppose. I also cited a few cases in the appellate division, published cases that have that very type of analysis in giving little weight to mitigating factor 7, where it's a young defendant and they say, okay, the defendant is entitled to mitigating factor 7, of course, but the judge didn't abuse his discretion in giving that in those cases in giving that factor little weight because of the brief period of time in light of the defendant's age, where the defendant has a lawful past and no prior record. And that's precisely what the judge in this case did. And disagreement with that is different than saying that the judge committed reversible error by abusing his discretion. And then lastly, and somewhat relatedly, as to her age and discussing her age, like I said, just generally speaking, the judge did not use it against her. He was referencing her age and discussing it and explaining why he was balancing the factors the way that he did. One last thing is that as far as the scientific studies that are cited by the defendant before this court, those weren't provided to either the sentencing judge or the appellate division on appeal and are now being provided to this court for the first time. So as far as they might then provide a basis for finding that the judge committed reversible error, the state would ask that they not be considered because they're now being presented for the first time before this court. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions your honors might have.
Counsel, you began your comments by saying that's the sentence she bargained for, correct?
Yes, it was.
But the plea bargain, and I have it in front of me, reserves in question number 21, the defense has the right to argue for the minimum 10-year. So right. How did she bargain for a 15-year sentence when the very instrument of the plea agreement provided her to argue for a lesser sentence?
Well, the state's recommended sentence, the aggregate, was 15 years.
But she wasn't, first of all, even if she didn't reserve the right to argue for 10, State versus Warren says the court can always give her a lesser sentence. But here, the plea agreement specifically says, I'm going to be arguing for 10 years. And, right. and you signed the agreement. When I say you, your office.
Right. And as your honor just indicated, that's always the defense's right. And I'm sure that courts always expect that they're going to argue for less. Otherwise,
Well, then you cannot say that she bargained for 15 when she's reserving the right to argue for a lesser sentence.
Well, I think that, I mean, that is, she knew that was going to be the recommended sentence, and her attorney in communicating with her and her signing the bargain, any defense attorney can always argue for less. They always do. Otherwise, I mean, oftentimes it's then argued as ineffective assistance of counsel on PCR. Sorry, Chief Justice.
Please finish your answer. Go ahead.
I mean, that's akin to saying that when a defendant waives the right to, or when a defendant automatically preserves the right to appeal from a denial of the suppression of physical evidence, that somehow that right not being waived is stronger if they specify it under that paragraph. It's superfluous. They know.
So let's focus on what the judge did, because that will tell us whether there's error in this case. Mitigating factor seven, if it's sufficient for a judge to simply say, you know, this person was young and could have committed more crime.
Doesn't that undermine the plain language of the mitigating factor altogether?
Well, I don't necessarily think so if that's it and that's the only thing that the judge said and the judge didn't find aggravating factor three and explain it, and he didn't say what Your Honor just referred to in reconciling the findings of aggravating factor three and mitigating seven, then it might be different. But I think here it was different because the judge was saying that in the context of also saying that aggravating factor three applies and is being given great weight because she's likely to commit more offenses. And it could also be different given the circumstances and background of a defendant who's 18 or 19 in referring to the brief period of time that she's been a law-abiding citizen. There might be circumstances unique to a defendant that would make that, let's say, like 10, 15 year period, whatever it may be, where it wouldn't then warrant little weight. And they overcame certain things, particular defendants, that would, although the period of time would be brief, that it would be actually moderate or great weight because it was likely, given the circumstances, that they would have committed an offense. So there could be things that could change it, but here they weren't there.
Your overall point that you made at the end of your opening statement begs the question, should youth be considered against a person at the time of sentencing?
Set aside the studies that you've suggested shouldn't be looked at. What about the trilogy of cases that the U.S. Supreme Court has had in the last decade and this court's relatively recent rulings on the subject as well? Don't they point in the opposite direction?
Well, those cases impose, generally speaking, they involve, you know, mandatory periods of parole ineligibility and certain greater requirements of courts at sentencing to protect against overly harsh sentences that are imposed upon juveniles. And also, she was not a juvenile, obviously. She was 18 when she committed the offense. So it's different in that regard. And again, I don't think the judge was using her age against her. He was using it specifically in the context of giving her the benefit of a mitigating factor. So I think to say, like, yes, he was explaining why her youth played a role in him giving less weight to the mitigating factor. So in that sense, it was used against her, I suppose. But it was in the context of applying a mitigating factor for her. So I don't think he was using it against her. And additionally, I mean, with the enactment of mitigating factor 14 moving forward, that is essentially, in just generally speaking, will prevent any use of a defendant's youthfulness against that defendant if they're 26 or under at the time of the offense. So I think if that might be a concern of the court, I mean, that would be alleviated specifically by the mitigating factor 14.
So is it your position then that what happened here is not reconcilable with the new aggravating factor 14 going forward?
Mitigating, excuse me.
Well, I mean, I suppose if that were, it would have to then be applied retroactively if that were to be the case. And it would then—
I'm just the theory.
If this happened today, your Honor is asking?
Yes.
Might be different then, yeah.
If this case went back for resentencing, would the court be able to consider mitigating 14?
Well, under State versus Bellamy, the published appellate division case, which obviously this court's not bound by, but that's the situation that they ruled on, where they say, although it's not fully retroactive and it should be applied prospectively, if a defendant's being resentenced for a separate reason at resentencing, as a defendant's always entitled to be considered, must be considered at the time of the resentencing, which means then that, yes, mitigating factor 14 would apply if there were a resentencing. I just want to also add that, I mean, we're talking about all of this for a defendant who got an incredibly favorable plea bargain. And I know that, of course, although plea bargains are entitled to a great deal of respect and deference by courts on review, that they still must follow the sentencing guidelines and follow the case law and do what's required of them by law. However, when we're talking about balancing factors, not just whether they apply or not necessarily, and weight that's given to those factors, that's when I think really the impact of the plea agreement that the defendant entered into with the state makes this not reversible error at all by Judge Jimenez and a proper exercise of discretion. I mean, the lowest possible sentence, if the defendant didn't get a step down, that she could have gotten under the plea agreement and what she pled to was 10 years, and she got 15, and that's at the low end of the range also. So although that's not dispositive, it does certainly play a big role here. I mean, this was basically a felony murder, and she got the benefit of an aggravated manslaughter and pled to that and the sentencing range that came along with it.
Be that as it may, we have certain rules that our judges must follow in determining whether certain mitigating or aggravating factors are in play. And if a judge uses an impermissible reason, we have specifically said that either the factor cannot be used or it has to be perhaps qualitatively lessened. So,
yes, Your Honor. And I'm not at all trying to say I just was trying to explain, say that obviously, I mean, the judge is still required, no matter how favorable a plea agreement is to a defendant, to apply the aggravating and mitigating factors that are present in the record and balance them. And that, like I said, I mean, the legal requirements of the sentencing judge don't then get negated by a very beneficial plea agreement. But the plea agreement still does play a role in analyzing his exercise of discretion in fulfilling that obligation and whether or not he committed reversible error. And the state's position is that that did not occur here at all.
Other questions for Mr. Galdieri? Anything you'd like to add?
No, that'll be it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Cooper Dodd.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. The Attorney General's main interest in this case is preserving the proper scope of sentencing review and also rejecting some unfounded per se rules about sentencing proposed by the defendant. There's a lot of discussion already in this argument about finding the likelihood of reoffense based on planning. And I think it really goes broader than that. If you look at the judge's analysis on page 11 of the sentencing transcripts, he does talk about how defendant had helped to plan this offense, had planned this offense together with Mr. Martinez. But he also mentioned, talking about the level of victimization involved in this case and talking not just about the planning, but also carrying out. And I think those are key parts of the analysis because it's not just about the planning. As was discussed at length already, the plan, the robbery did not go exactly according to plan. It was meant to be committed in the Bronx, apparently on the street or something. But when that original plan went wrong, while the defendant was then faced with, if she wanted it, a great opportunity to withdraw from the plan and say, well, things didn't go according to plan, I'll back out of this. Instead, she kept the plan moving, despite additionally learning that the victim Garcia had a gun, and thus, of course, greatly increasing the chance of a violent confrontation. So instead of giving up the plan, she kept it moving. She alerted Martinez as to their new location, and she specifically alerted Martinez as to the fact that Garcia, the victim, had a gun, which seems also foreseeable to make him and as it turns out, his co-defendant Mingo, take violent action immediately rather than attempting perhaps a less immediately violent approach to this crime. There was also much discussion earlier about applying aggravating three on the basis of the depravity of the crime. And as I pointed out, the judge did discuss the level of victimization here. And I think you can see in the way that defendant did basically target these people who are completely unknown to her via social media, lure them into this plan. And then of course, also leaving both Garcia, well, Torres apparently was dead, but leaving the victim Garcia for dead, bleeding on a hotel room floor and returning to the Bronx and selling the items they'd taken from them. So there's much more to it than just the planning that went into the judge's finding that there was a likelihood of reoffense here. And that seems to be all, that's all of course supported by the plea and the information in the pre-sentence report. And of course all goes to a broader examination of likelihood of reoffense down the road. Touching also on the arguments about how that the argument that the planning must be for the exact offense. The defendants relied on one case for that, which is State v. Sherman, and it simply does not state such a rule. It's never been cited for such a rule. And while it did draw a line saying that the defendant there had planned a kidnapping, that it was okay to apply planning and aggravating three on the basis of planning to the kidnapping offense, it should not apply to the endangering offense. It seems from that opinion that there is actually a much larger temporal and conceptual difference between those offenses. It is a little bit difficult to tell from that opinion what exactly the basis of the endangering offense on, though it appears it's that the room in which the six-year-old kidnapping victim was kept also contained a bottle of poisonous photographic chemicals, which was completely unrelated to, it was basically incidental in the fact that this the defendant Sherman there had seemingly just forgotten that this chemical was in there. Having that, yes, he had certainly not planned to endanger his kidnapping victim in that sense. Whereas in this case, the death of Torres and grave wounding of Garcia was an intrinsic component of the offense. And even if it was not specifically planned, it was very closely related to it and essentially foreseeable, particularly once the defendant knew that Garcia was also armed. Then turning also to look at considering aggravating factor 7 and how the age of a defendant might play in there, it certainly seems logical that one logical approach to a qualitative weighing mitigating factor 7 in terms of lack of criminal record would be the length of time the defendant has lived a law-abiding life or had a lack of a criminal record. And of course, only an older defendant can have a very long time of living a law-abiding life. Defendant who is 19 at the time of sentencing is about as young as an adult defendant is likely to be at the time of sentencing.
Okay. So let's take
counsel, counsel, there's a disjunctive in
mitigating 7. It's or has led a law-abiding life for a substantial period of time. Don't you have to address the first part, which speaks for itself? The defendant has no history of prior delinquency or criminal activity?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, you're correct about the disjunctive, of course. I see what you're saying. If there's to be any weighing of that part of mitigating factor 7, it's hard to see what basis it would be. It certainly seems like a 55-year-old defendant who's has no criminal record should receive greater weight than an 18-year-old defendant. That seems like a logical disconnect. If they were to say, well, youth cannot be used to lighten the weight of mitigating factor 7, then it becomes somewhat unclear whether age could be used to give that factor heavier weight.
Here, and I would like you to address the language on page 13 of the sentencing transcript, where the judge says, quote, she hasn't had enough time to begin a history of criminal activity, and I'll put dot, dot, dot. That is why I gave great weight to the fact that the risk she'll commit another offense, aggravating factor number 3. Do you think that's appropriate?
Well, Your Honor, I think that maybe what's important in that statement is what was in the dot, dot, dot.
Okay, go ahead.
Which is being that the judge said she hasn't had enough time to begin a history of criminal activity, which I most certainly think she would have been the case. And that, and I would read it as that being the fact that he had previously, on the
right,
two pages prior, found her likely to commit offense. So he's okay, reiterating, saying, I think this is his explanation. I think this has been discussed already, but this is the judge's explanation of how it is that a likelihood of reoffense
can be
consistent with a lack of criminal history.
But he's not sentencing her the moment after she's walking out of the motel. He's now sentencing her after she has pled guilty, expressed remorse, and that cooperated with the prosecutor's office against the co-defendants. So the question is whether or not that remark at that moment, as she's appearing before the court, is appropriate. Like, she's now standing before the court. She's going to be going to jail for some period of time. And whether or not those remarks are appropriate under the circumstances. Go ahead.
I guess I'm not sure what you mean in what sense appropriate. It seemed from the text of it, it looks as if she's stepping back for a moment to aggravating factor three. So what she's found based on the facts of the crime.
Is it likely that she is going to commit another offense on the day of sentence, not before when she was caught? That's the moment that the judge has to determine whether or not aggravating factor three applies. Do you agree?
Yes, Your Honor. I agree that certainly aggravating factor three, certainly all of these factors are measured on the day of sentencing. Although, as I think was touched on, the fact that she was captured does not seem to generally, the fact that she is facing a presumptive term of incarceration and that she was captured is not something that is generally weighed in that, even though that may well make someone less likely to reoffend if we're assuming that they will be in prison for a number of years. But that's not weighed at that moment, although that information is before the court. Looking for a moment again at youth as applied to aggravating factor seven, mitigating factor seven. There's a lot of discussion of these cases, the U.S. Supreme Court trilogy, and also the more recent cases from this court like Zuber. Those cases really concern entirely sort of the lack of culpability, lack of blameworthiness that we find in young offenders based on their still developing brains. They're still on psychological factors at play there. So it's clear that there is a sort of consensus that there's a lack of culpability, a lack of blameworthiness. But what we're talking about in applying youth to mitigating factor seven is entirely different. Mitigating factor seven has nothing to do with culpability and blameworthiness. And it's really not in any way inconsistent to say, even simultaneously, we're going to find that this defendant may be somewhat less culpable, somewhat less blameworthy because of her young age. And simultaneously, mitigating factor seven gets only lightweight because, as opposed to a very old defendant with no criminal record, this is a very young defendant with criminal record, with no criminal record. Those are the main points I wanted to make. I'm happy to field any additional questions as well.
Hearing none, Mr. Cooper-Dobb, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Burke, rebuttal?
As Justice Albin pointed out, this is not an excessiveness point here. I'm not arguing that the 15 couldn't necessarily be the ultimate sentence that the judge decides to impose here, but the trial court, in order to impose this sentence, has to give a clear explanation for why. And here, there just was not that clear explanation. The age being used against Ms. Rivera, and in fact, the state here says that if anything, it was the only reason that he used to reduce the weight of mitigating factor seven, and in that sense, is being used against her. But and at the very least, it's confusing whether he's also using it to weigh heavily the aggravating factor three. And this court should remand to make sure that that's not the facts, or that the trial court here is not actually using that in aggravation. But Ms. Rivera does believe that this was used against her, and her age should never be used in aggravation. And the other reasons that the court gave, the fact that she was not, or that if she hadn't been arrested yet, she would be likely to reoffend. And because she had planned the robbery, that this manslaughter was now likely to, or supported the likelihood of reoffense, could not provide this reasoned explanation that this court required in State v. Case. For that reason, we do ask that this court remand for Ms. Rivera to be resentenced.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.